Okay, for this week on Crucial Tech, I'm going to make an apology to begin with. I usually try to keep things under 30 minutes, but this one's going to be over an hour, folks. It's important to listen to. You can break into it anytime you want. But I was asked to be on a panel a few weeks ago, moderated by Dr. Andrew Wood, who is the department chair for communications department chair at San Jose State University, my alma mater. And we were joined with Hadi Hirsti, who is an election security expert, and Sadi Stenforth, who is a very smart woman. She is a sociologist, a mathematician, and a futurist, who has been recognized for her work by Forbes magazine. So I asked myself, why in the world am I here? But I went ahead anyway. It was a fascinating discussion. And now that the election is over November, I wanted to put this out because that way I'm not influencing anybody. But we need to be thinking things going forward. I think we kind of dodged a bullet in the radical nature of politics that has been growing. And we are talking about whether democracy can survive in this world. My particular part was how media plays into it. So I hope you learned something from this. I certainly did. And it gives me hope. It really gives me hope. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Andrew Wood.
The SJSU Department of Communication Studies has organized an international panel of experts who gathered together to explore the present and the future of democracy. And the goal here is for it to be a dynamic and interdisciplinary conversation, and one that, if we succeed, will both inform you and inspire you. And so I'd like to introduce the three speakers that I'm actually here to listen to and learn from, even though I have the task of helping to moderate the conversation. Really, we're here to listen to these three experts. And so we're going to hear from Lou Covey, a cybersecurity market analyst and chief editor of Cyber Protection Magazine. Lou will help us better understand the role of traditional and emerging media in shaping public perceptions about, well, things that we would presume aren't questionable, but are increasingly questionable, like credibility, expertise, and even the value of the vote. We're also going to hear from Hadi Hirsti, a cybersecurity advisor, a computer programmer, and a voting security expert. Hadi is going to help us examine questions concerning elections, audits, and the digital means to either protect democracy or, frankly, to destroy it. And Sadi Stenforth is a Forbes 50 futurist, a mathematician, and a sociologist. Sadi will help us reflect upon the roles of artificial intelligence, blockchain technologies, even, depending on how the conversation goes, quantum mechanics to help us enable our imagination of alternative futures of democracy. A common theme is that while, of course, we have an imminent election in the United States coming in less than 2 weeks, the midterm elections, we're talking about a global context of democracy. And so we're going to hear a globe filled of examples and perspectives, and I really look forward to it. Toward that end, let's begin. And I'm going to suggest that we might begin with Lou and then hear from Hadi and then Sadi, but we'll work this out in a more flexible manner. But we might hear first from Lou, and then I'm going to ask everyone to consider the same question. What is your personal and professional experience, and how have those personal and professional experiences shaped how you approach democracy in today's world? Lou, how do you approach a question like that?
Well, from my perspective as a journalist, and I take a little bit of exception with you calling me an expert. No journalist is an expert on anything. A journalist just knows where to find experts and ask them questions, and that's what I am. But looking back through history, media has been involved in the process of pushing societies through, even in democracies, going back as far as ancient Greece. Because when a runner would come in and tell bad news, the first thing they did is they killed the runner. So that's that's just natural in journalism. But from a U.S. perspective, disinformation and misinformation and lies in the media are nothing new. Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton were constantly lying in the media about each other and then would blame the media on the lies. So it's nothing new that we've seen. The problem we have is that we have this myth of that we distrust the media. And I'm using the media in quotes because there really is no such thing as the media. There are multiple mediums. There is print, there is broadcast, there is cable, there is YouTube. We've got more channels of media than we've ever had in the history of humanity. And the fact of the matter is that some are more trusted than others. A recent survey that I was reading showed that the most distrusted media is social media. 90% of the people that responded said, no, they don't trust social media. But here's the paradox of trust. It's the primary source of information for people. Something like, I think it was around 70% of the US population alone gets most of their news from social media, but they don't trust it. On the other hand, surveys show that the most trusted medium is print, and yet it is the least consumed medium. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we've got this paradox where people say, oh, I don't trust the media. Well, what it comes down to is that people will gravitate to the media source that validates their worldview. You know, so, and even at the point of saying, well, I don't trust the media, so I'm going to go to the medium that I least trust to get my information and therefore validate why I don't trust the media. But the reality is that most people can read faster than most people can talk. In fact, students are known to be can read three times faster than someone can talk. And yet, where do we go to get our media, our news? We talk about social media. We talk about broadcasts. We talk about cable. YouTube is very popular. But so the thing is that when we are going after that kind of medium, we are getting less information than we could if we read. And the thing is, visual media, according to Marshall McLuhan, it appeals to emotion. We see it reacting immediately, and we're not really thinking it through. We are just responding to it. Whereas auditory media can appeal equally to emotion and intellect, because even though we're using a sensory issue to get the information, we still have to put the picture in our heads. So we're engaging our brain in that process. But print, on the other hand, is appealing primarily to intellect. You've got to picture everything in your head. You've got to picture the words. You've got to hear the voices. So people are more engaged by that. And that's one of the things that we've got to consider when we're looking at getting informed in a democracy about where we can get the best and most information. And that doesn't mean one particular source. That doesn't mean Fox News or the Washington Post or whatever you're getting it from. But the problem is with social media is that it combine all three of these areas. It can combine the emotional, the intellectual, the visual. And the purpose is to engage the audience. And the easiest way to engage the audience is to anger them. That's how you'll get comments. And that's what will drive the advertising revenue. So social media is focused on an emotional response, not the intellectual response. So from my perspective, going back to your question, how can we fix democracy with our media consumption? Well, we need to stop watching and start reading. That's it.
Something tells me we're going to return to a phrase that you used, the paradox of trust, a little later on. And if you don't mind, Lou, I want to throw in one other thing, and that is you are a proud SJSU graduate, are you not?
Yes, I am.
And I want our SJSU students to know that our graduates go off to do great things.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I was the teaching assistant for the last 2 years that Dr. Dwight Bentle was the head of the School of Journalism that he founded.
And SJSU students might recognize that name when they walk around campus and see a building of the same name.
Yep.
I'd like to also open up the floor to our other participants to talk about their personal and professional experience and how it shapes how they look at the question and the potential of democracy. Let's hear from Hari.
I'm basically going to be first commenting the previous speaker. So first of all, when we look into the modern communication, what is really dangerous memes? Because memes are giving you instant picture, or in TikTok, instant video, which triggers your brain to have emotional reaction before your brain, monkey brain, gets to the part of actually thinking and having the defenses. And the fundamental problem is we don't have a human firewall. We don't educate people anymore to have a critical thinking, social critics in a very young age. And even if we would have that training, it doesn't work in an area of an instant media exposure like memes and TikTok. It's also interesting because no matter what kind of current thinking we have in a media filtering, it doesn't work. And really, Cambridge Analytica showed that when you have a micro-targeting capability, you can tailor your message in such a slow volumes that if you look those messages today and put them in the AI filter, you don't have a critical mass to trigger it. So we are already knowing how to attack mind, and that's why we have the war with other means, minds under siege, through this capability of micro-targeting, micro-customization, micro-generating messages, which are triggering your monkey brain, but not triggering the AI, which we could use to filter it. And that was just a comment for the previous speaker.
And I'm going to ask one other question of you, and that is, you are not in the United States right now. As I understand, you are in Germany. Is that correct?
That is correct. Originally, this original schedule, I was supposed to be in Kuala Lumpur, and when this was changed for 1 week later, now I'm in Munich, Germany. So 18 time zones in 1 week.
And all the more, we appreciate your participating in this. We understand that things may change given that you are sort of in betwixt and in between, but we are delighted to hear from you and look forward to learning more, particularly about notions of micro-targeting and micro-messaging. But we also want to hear from Sari Stenforce. Remember, we approach this in an interdisciplinary way, and I can't imagine a more interdisciplinary presenter than Sari. And I know that's maybe overselling, but truthfully, a mathematician, a sociologist, and more. So Sari, maybe you can help us understand how you're approaching these questions.
Yeah, so I think I'm here as a futurist. I've been working on foresight methods for couple of decades, and foresight is about different tools to be able to envision a future. And I started out as doing mathematic models and economic models of futures, and that's what I did for a long, long time. And but the situation is very different right now. And our historical data doesn't really tell much about what the future looks like, especially because these are very difficult and very interesting in many ways times for the humankind. We've got all environmental catastrophes ahead of us, most likely, if we don't really do something. Democracy is really in question in many countries, Western world, more and more of a critique of it. There's polarization, digital divide, all sorts of very personal issues that are happening in our societies. So the answers that we used to get from economic models and predictions like that don't work anymore. So a couple of years ago, I decided to change gear. I saw that media most often predicted our future as being a catastrophe or dystopia, and Hollywood gives us dystopians. And when I was doing my projections to the future for different organizations and countries that I work for, all our effort went into what to do about these catastrophes and in a way that looked at everything from a dystopian worldview. And I noticed that there were no hopeful futures. Nobody was telling us what it would look like if we succeeded. Like Harri was saying, our monkey brain is geared towards fear and catastrophes. Somehow when we were in our caves and our brains were still working in a caveman way, our brains developed in a way that the catastrophizing actually is the last thing that develops in our brain. And that is still developing in our 20s and early 30s. Can you believe that? So we love catastrophizing. We just totally are, especially in our years before 30 years, we just totally get on with catastrophizing and fear. And it's very important to understand that in our brain, that we love that. And it's very hard for us to have any thoughts of what long-term hopeful futures look like, because we get into these catastrophizing holes. And then we can't get out of, we dig deep in those and we can't get out of there. Even though no matter how logical and how knowledgeable person you are, this is how our brain works. So this is about neuroplasticity and taking other ways of foresight in order to be able to see hopeful futures. And that's what I'm specialized nowadays. I do long-term hopeful futures, and I'm right now working on a TV series, which is sort of like a white mirror. It's a drama series of hopeful futures in 2092 for us all to get some visions of what 2092 could look like as a hopeful future. Not a utopian future, that's not where we're gonna get. We're dramatic human beings, we're gonna screw it up no matter what, but it can be much better. And I think we have all the means, all the innovations that are needed for a hopeful future. We just need to envision it. So that's how I look at democracy and our political situation. What is there that we could turn into a hopeful future?
And it will be ironic that my question will beat us back into the past, borrowing, I guess, a little bit of from some rather famous literature, that we are beaten ceaselessly into the past. But we will come back to the future, I assure you. But I'm drawn to something that you said, Sari, and that is that our historical data doesn't tell much about what the future looks like. On the one hand, that's freedom, that we're not stuck in the past. But on the other hand, it might be useful to consider maybe the comparative roles of the traditional, another way of putting it is the historical print, versus the contemporary social media. And there appears to have been some change in terms of how media have shaped our confidence in the electoral process. Now, Lou is maybe ideally suited to help us observe that change, but we can all weigh in on the role of media and the paradox of trust. But Lou, maybe you'd get us started. How have traditional print media provided a differing future than contemporary social media do?
Well, as Sari pointed out, and even Harri with his comment about memes, I mean, it's focused on, he said monkey brain, I consider it to be the lizard brain. Mm. The focus is on making us feel bad, because that's supposed to make us do something. I mean, when we are complacent, we don't do anything. And yeah, and we've seen that happen again and again in the 2016 election. We got complacent, and that made a change. But in the print media side, And, you know, I'm part of that, but I also have a podcast. I also do videos and things like that. The idea is to expand the concept, kind of like what Sari is thinking about, taking a look at the other options. And what I find in print is that I have more options to take a look at, because the average length of a news story on television is 90 seconds. Okay, that's all you've got. So you've got to punch it really hard to get people to watch it. And that usually means something negative. But in print, like take the Washington Post. I read the Washington Post every day. And one of the things I've noticed is they do have a lot of opinions, which pisses me off. But at the same time, they have opinions on both sides and in the middle. Mm-hmm. So I get a chance to see the entire spectrum in essentially the same time it would take to watch 30 minutes of news. And so that changes my position. And it really ticks a lot of people off when I'm talking to them on social media, because it seems like I'm a contrarian. I disagree with everyone. And that's because everyone's at these extremes. And we have to pull people more to the center to see what the potential for good is. I mean, just take a look at our economy. We think the economy is crap right now. But the United States, compared to the rest of the world, is doing quite well. The price of gas has actually dropped $1.50 on average throughout the nation. Our level of inflation is less than half of what it is in the United Kingdom. We have more people getting jobs, but we have this basic feeling that everything is falling apart. It really isn't. We're actually on an upward trend. And that's what we have to get across, is that the changes that we are making are generally for the better. And going back to the way it was is not as good as it should, as we thought it was. That's where I am.
You know, in a moment, I'm going to ask for Hari to think about the contemporary state of elections in the United States and to reflect on what you have observed, Hari. And then in a couple moments, I want us to focus even more on some of those alternative futures. But if I may, I want to drill a little bit more into something you implied. And that is, if you read the Washington Post and you look at their editorial board and you look at the editorials that are published, they do seem to make an attempt to show numbering a number of perspectives. But when you watch, let's say, MSNBC or Fox News, or even CNN to some degree, you might be forgiven for thinking that there really is only one echo chamber of ideas. Is there a marketplace of ideas that people can find where they can genuinely hear alternative perspectives? And if so, where do you think it is?
First of all, I would like to comment, more than anything else, about the fact that even when you're positive thinking, it actually is right now undermined by subliminal messaging. Finnish brain researcher Leif Åberg was one of the founders of understanding how subliminal messaging can be used in malicious marketing. He used that to sell alcohol and other things. But when we look what happened in 2016 and we look the Russian bots, which were used to promote certain candidates, none of the advertising actually mentioned the candidate's name. It was about hunting. It was all about positive things. The negative messages were anti-vaxxing from the same bots and targeting the same audiences. So it was a mixed messages. And remember, 2016, anti-vaxxing was not as important as right now. So you can turn good things bad in that way. Now, about the modern elections, I would like to point from the idea of why we are right now in the mess we are. The whole idea of secret ballot is fairly new. It was invented in Tasmania, Australia, and first time used there 1853. For some reason in Australia, people didn't trust each other, maybe because it was penal colony, maybe. But the idea was that in order to stop people beating each other up when they are voting with their own mind instead of with the general consensus, that was triggering the idea of secret ballot. Secret ballot took 50 years to come to US. It was first time used in US general elections in 1896. And meanwhile, the beating up people who voted wrong had got in a disproportionately big problem. And a lever machine was invented. Lever machine, the physical calculator where you go to booth, you pull the lever, and it calculates the votes. The idea was not to make election more accurate. The idea was not to get results faster. The idea was to eliminate the evidence how people voted. To eliminate the paper ballot so that people don't get beaten up. Of course, this led in Pennsylvania to famous shoe police attack, where when you came to the booth, you found out that all the buttons of undecided candidates were covered with a thick black shoe polish. And you were prohibited to have a pen, pencil, hand sneaker, or gloves, anything you would allow to push the button without getting your fingers dirty. So US took a path in election where the idea was to stop voter coercion instead of anything else. The voter coercion prevention became the number one topic, not the accuracy, not the auditability, not anything else. Now we are in that mess because the electronic voting, which we tried and we are thankfully getting out of in the US, is the brainchild of the lever machines. It's following the same path. Auditability was never a big topic because the coercion was so overwhelmingly big problem. So we really didn't think about that. And when we look what happens today with all the misinformation campaigns, disinformation campaigns put out there, they are riding now the wave which was set in 1920s with a lever machine. How to get out of this is really to use more information and more transparency. Return paper ballot, explain why paper ballot is no longer the threat. Get a lot of these bad stigmas, which people still carry in their mind. You know, the classical, my grandmother did something and I don't know why I'm repeating it. And the reason is long gone, we're still repeating it. So we are really in the situation where we have to go to 1920s, look for the wrong choices we make back then in order to help us to correct this trend. And as was mentioned before, all the founding fathers were bad-mouthing each other. Misinformation, disinformation, Lisa is nothing new. Mm-hmm. To have a Putin's amplifier to boost that message, it's just making it worse, but it's nothing new. We need to go back to the source to understand how to fix this.
Let's consider that as a jumping-off point to invite Sari to reflect on either the past or the future, because the question you asked, Hari, is how do we get out of this? Sari, what are your thoughts? Do we imagine that we need to go back to the future? Or do we need to imagine entirely new frameworks for democracy? Because we have the power to do that if we have the imagination. How would you get us started thinking in an imaginary way that can be productive?
I totally will start.
Yeah. Oh, and so let's hear from Sari.
Yeah, I totally would use a method from my futurist suitcase that is called Future Backwards. And I would start with going far enough in the future to think what would be amazing futures. I always use the 2092 year as my future because it takes about 7 years for something that is invented today to become everyday in our society, everyday behaviors. So, you know, if we stay the same, our bodies learn in the same way. If we don't somehow become better, faster in learning new things and adapting new technologies, it's about 7 years. So 2092. If you could do anything, what would the democracy or the new political methods and systems, what would they look like in 2092? They could be completely different. If you think of democracy, democracy is about majority of the members always getting to say how things are done. Is that actually needed in the future? Perhaps not. I think equity and inclusion is really important. Maybe we could have a smaller communities that could vote, that would be more into inclusion, certain things are for smaller communities more important, and maybe we could have more important issues happening in smaller communities. And I think that trend is already happening. You see that a lot of the cities like San Francisco is taking a lot of responsibility of issues that used to be state level or federal level, even like immigration, healthcare, education. All those issues are big ticket items in communities like San Francisco. And I see this more and more happening all over the world. Big cities. I just came from a conference called World City, and where cities like New York, huge cities, are working together with other cities and taking more and more responsibility of the happiness of people being in their city and the city vicinities too. So they always also care about farmers that provide food for their cities. So maybe we could have a system, a political system, where the cities could be in the middle of it, so that the smaller communities living in the cities and in the metropolitan areas could have their votes on things that are near us, because we do have these physical bodies. And at the same time, we have our digital presence, which is more and more all the time, all these metaverse worlds and all that. And we're going to be more and more present in at the globe level. So maybe we could have some sort of representation, some type of a new UN governance or something like that, that is at the global level. Because during COVID, we figured out that we are in the same boat. No matter how much you earn, who you are, where you are, we're in the same boat. So that could be one vision in the horizon of 2092, talking about options. We could have completely new political system that would be local and global. And maybe we could work with that. And democracy could look very different in there. And there are many other options if we don't start from like, how do we fix this one? But like, what can we envision? What kind of options could there be?
You know, I want to follow up on that with an observation that you appeared to emphasize the role of inclusiveness as a value. And you're talking about various ways to include voices. And one presumes, and I may be wrong, but one may presume that suggests that inclusiveness and democracy are innately positive values. Okay. But for the sake of conversation, is it possible that we are necessarily entering a post-democratic era? And is that necessarily a bad thing? In other words, do we need more voices, or do we need the voices of experts, or is that an entirely unfair dichotomy? Who would like to take a stab at helping me to get—
Can I, Andy, say something about that? Because that's something I totally want to say. So in those options in 2092, that's definitely an option. We could easily do that. We could, for example, instead of having representatives that we have now in our senates or wherever we live in different democratic systems, we could set who is the expert that represents us in certain issues. Let's say if it's some sort of environmental issues, we could give all our votes for the expert that knows about, in our opinion, the most about environmental issues, and this person could just, all our systems could be run by experts. This is totally also a possible future, and we definitely should figure out what would that look like and how could we do that.
Well, given that Lou disabused us of the notion of Lou's expertise, although I'm going to respectfully push back and say, I think, Lou, you bring a great deal of expertise. What do you think about this business of the expert and democracy? How do you think those may align or disconnect?
The problem is that we've got this black and white concept of democracy. Mm. And that doesn't exist. I mean, democracy is a concept, and it changes according to culture. In Athens, it was men and men who owned property. And we tried to do that once here in the United States too. But that means it's not a true democracy, because a true democracy means everybody has a choice. But at the same time, as John Adams pointed out, we're not a country of men. We are a country of laws. And that's what we're supposed to be, so that the law takes precedence over the will of the majority. But we're not there anymore. So our democracy has changed. At one point, you know, if you wanted to change something, you went through the legislature and they debated it and they came out with a compromise, and that's what you got. But over the past 50 years, the Supreme Court has become more of a legislative body than the legislature. And we've just seen that in how they're overturning various precedents that have been around for half a century, for decades. So democracy does change. And I think we're at a point right now with the discussion that we're having about the media, about technology, about how democracy should change. We're in that process of changing that. I don't know what it's going to look like, but the only consistent thing about democracy is that it does change.
Yeah. Going back to Heraclitus, one can never step into the same river twice. I'd like to ask Hari to help us get a sense of what we can expect in the imminent future. The question is, I think a lot of our audience are really wondering, how safe, how dependable will elections be in the United States for the midterms? The world is filled with many more elections than those in the United States, but given that many of the audience are probably very interested in that, Hari, what do you see happening in the next couple of weeks? Will this be an election that goes down as a successful one, or is it going to open up Pandora's box?
So first of all, I want to comment one thing about the U.S., who had the right to vote, because there's a famous poem about that. Because the actual who had the right to vote was men with donkey. Hmm. And there's a famous poet who would say, well, who is actually the power then invested to man to or the donkey? And of course, there was a very cherishing donkey rental business back those days, because the donkey doesn't need to be owned. It can be rented to have. But the more importantly, I want to touch two things. Technology is not a solution for voting problems. First of all, voting is a unique problem, because you need to have two things at the same time: secret ballot and auditability. The common misconception is to say banking secret is the same as election secret. It's not, because in banking secret, your bank knows how much money you have. The receiver's bank knows who you're sending money to. Your receiver can prove you sent the money, and you can prove. In the election, you have to be able to maintain a secret, even if me as a voter want to cooperate. Because if I can prove how I voted, I can sell my vote, I can my wife can vote, or I can be coerced to vote certain ways. So it has to be the election vote, the secret ballot has to protect me, against my coercion. Also, I want to point out that it's a wonderful thing to be here in Germany, because in Germany, they have two very interesting laws. The first law is to say every man and woman has to be able to understand how votes are counted without no special education or tools. The second thing is that if you prove that the votes can be changed, a new election is ordered, you don't have to prove that it actually happened. You have to prove it was possible. It could have happened. Now we are, first of all, blockchain, it's a solution looking for a problem and haven't found any problem it can solve. So it's useless for every practical purpose. If we look, the most promising technology is homomorphic encryption. One of the inventors of homomorphic encryption is my friend. He's a little bit younger than I am. He believes homomorphic encryption will solve this problem, but not in his lifetime. Furthermore, if I would be needing to explain 70, 80-year-old poll worker how homomorphic encryption works, not going to work. So we cannot solve this thing with technology. Now about mine, what keeps me night awake 2020 and 2024 elections? politically motivated parties has taken a lot of copies, illegal copies of election servers across the US. As a security practitioners, we always assume that the adversary has a copy of the software. So that's not the point at all. So what is the point why it keeps me awake at the night? If I have a copy of ESNS, Dominion, whatever election software it is, I install it to a blank machine, and I try to create false evidence, an expert like myself and thousands of other experts, we will immediately tell this is a false evidence, this didn't happen. Once we have a copy of a real server from that jurisdiction, we can create a false evidence where all the small invisible bread crumbles are in the right place. Now it's very much harder to, and to, it's compelling, harder to explain why this fake. It's the same way as if I'm given a picture and say, is this Photoshop? And it's actually a deep fake. Current deep fakes will pass. There's not Photoshop because it was not Photoshop. And if somebody's producing this kind of false evidence and you're starting to use unusual tools, which are the good ones for deep fakes, you are in a situation where you say, well, this is a fishing expedition. Why don't you use the normal tools? So we are right now coming to a place where I think the election is safe because there's so many eyeballs. What I'm worried about is a orchestrated, well-motivated, well-funded effort, which is based on the images, stolen images, illegal copies of images from jurisdictions. We don't know the copies were made. To create false evidence, and that false evidence will be showing a hack which never happened to happen to completely undermine the trust of the people. So we are right now in the real worry in my mind is people who orchestrated and funded these copies and could be using those to create false evidence. Just to make this even worse, my pillow guy Mike Lindell has been very vocal, and he published two images which a year ago were shared in his event, and they're from Mesa County, Colorado. If you analyze the second image, you see that they're hardware profiles which were never used by Dominion systems or used by Colorado. This is not an evidence. I'm just saying that what is the logical conclusion, educated guess. I would say somebody was already trying to build a rogue server. So I'm worried, and I have a more reason than just my guess and gut feeling that somebody could be trying to do this.
With that, there's a lot going on in this reply, and I'm not going to do justice to all of it, but I want to circle to something you said earlier, and that is, and I hope I'm not misquoting, that there is not going to be a technological solution. And I don't want to put Sari into the box of being the tech futurist, but Sari has expertise also in AI and in blockchain. And since blockchain was cited here, I'd like for you, Sari, to weigh in on the role of blockchain, potentially AI, and maybe even quantum mechanics as a way of thinking about the technology of democracy. What say you, Sari?
Yeah, so I'm looking here from 2092. Back to there to 2022. And what it looks like for me first of all, I think blockchain can be used in creating, organizing socially in different ways. So it doesn't necessarily have to be blockchain, but it can be some sort of data architectural system that can decentralize us. So we could have decentralized political systems. And I think that would look very different from what we now have, because our political systems are super centralized. So what would it look like if we just could be voters all having just one vote and be decentralized? That would be a very different system. And then also I think of the AI, I think perhaps we could all in here in 2092, perhaps we all have political AI assistants. And our political AI assistants keep an eye on what's happening in different advertising fields and what's going on and what kind of memes I'm being fed. And my AI assistant gives me tips on what it looks like. And I can tell my AI assistant that, hey, this is what I like and this is what I don't look like, and look for the candidates that would be good for me. to vote on or anything like that. And I do think that is also a possibility that I would have these AI assistants that would have very specific functions in my life. And one could be politics. So that right now it's so hard to know everything about my candidates, what they are doing. I don't have enough capacity to really keep track of what the candidates are doing. But I could put my AI assistants to follow them and then I could be better at voting. And then that might mean if I had more capacity because I had such a great AI assistant, is that I could maybe be more involved in voting at different levels. And then what I wanted to say about quantum physics is that I totally believe in quantum physics because more and more research shows that actually any chunk of matter can occupy two places at once. So what it means that there are these superpositions and two things can be true at the same time. And that's specifically why I want to be this hopeful futurist, because I believe that if you believe in a hopeful future, that's actually going to happen. So if we do see hopeful futures, then, hey, there's nothing that will keep us from actually that coming true. So that is how I would now coming to this election, because the question is, who am I going to vote right now? So what coming from 2092, looking back at 2022, who would you vote for right now? What would give us this hopeful future? And I've been really thinking about it because democracy is in such critical state and it really is going to change. So I would definitely think about the new work and the work of a politician. And all of us, most all of us that have a job to do or working on our passion or something, the main question is, how can I make myself unemployed? What can I do in my work right now that is going to stop this job needing to be happening? And I think we all should be thinking about that. And I definitely will be thinking when I'm voting now, is who are the politicians that are thinking in that way a little bit longer term? What are they doing to become unemployed so that they're so good at their jobs that they make themselves unemployed? And that will give us the possibility of taking the next step. And looking at the world politics, I think China has been running this long game for a long, long time. And the results are clear because they have been thinking in this long chess game. And we here in the US, where, you know, the length of a political cycle is 4 years. That's nothing. So clearly this short game doesn't work in getting us the hopeful future, but the long game does. So I definitely would look at politicians that are working on this long game.
And so for all of our guests and audience members, one of the gifts of this conversation is thinking, who has the view from 92? And those candidates, regardless of where they are politically, who are thinking in terms of generations rather than the next cycle, might incline us to think differently about what and whom we value. As we're getting close to the state of this conversation where we're going to encourage maybe some questions and answers, I think we have time for just one more comment in this general area. And I'd like Lou to maybe reflect on the space of the media. That is, we know the four corners of the print newspaper are going to work differently than the kind of hyperspace of television. But then, you know, you hear about efforts to create kind of a metaverse where people will interact, and that maybe that will be a more meaningful way of producing and sharing our ideas and our values. I'm throwing this at you, Lou. I don't know if you've really have a lot of interest in the metaverse, but do you think that, you know, internet spaces can or shall provide more meaningful opportunities for genuine deliberation than the media that we've used thus far? Lou, what do you think?
It can, but whether it will happen in my lifetime, I doubt it. And I kind of like what Sari had to say, that, you know, these kind of things take like, what, 75 years to get us to. And just from a technical standpoint, let's go back to Oculus. Okay, I was at a dinner sitting, just happened to be sitting next to Lucky Palmer. This was a couple of years ago. This is right after Facebook bought Oculus. And we were talking about the future of virtual reality. And he said flat out, we don't have the computing power to make his version of, or what Mark Zuckerberg wants to do with virtual reality. It doesn't exist. We would have to increase the number of data servers in the world by a factor of 100 to get to that point. And by telling this to a journalist who was writing about it, Mr. Palmer lost his job a couple of weeks later. But that's the reality, is that we're nowhere near for the metaverse being able to step in and take care of that. But at the same time, we are seeing technology changes that do make the process of citizen involvement better. I mean, I like to refer to what Hari has done in his work, getting us away from digital voting machines. At one point, about a third of the counties in the United States were using them. Today, less than 6% of the counties in the United States are using them. We're almost totally on paper ballots. And that in itself decentralizes the process of voting in the United States, because you've got to have multiple people involved. You've got every county has their own rules. Every state has their own rules governing the counties. And then you have the federal government giving a few other rules involved. So I don't think we're there yet, but I think the process is developing. And more importantly, because I've talked about this about social media is losing its power. Just in the past couple of weeks, we learned that Facebook and Google have seen dramatic drops in the revenue they get from advertising. And more advertisers are saying digital advertising doesn't work. And that is what drives social media, is the advertising dollars. That's going away. So what are we going to replace it with? Well, we've got lots of things. And one of them is newspapers. One of them is local coverage, citizen journalism. So we are in the process of seeing going from a centralization of the media to a decentralization of it. And I think we're going to see that before we ever see the metaverse happen.
You know, let's focus on that notion of citizen journalism and the idea that all people who define themselves as citizens ought to contribute, not merely consume, but contribute to the maintenance of public life. And in that spirit, I'm noting that we're reaching toward the end of the time in which we're going to have a kind of a not a scripted, but a certainly planned set of topics that we wanted to tackle. But there are other citizens in this room who might want to share a question or two. And I know there's some talk of maybe using the chat feature, but unless I'm totally misunderstanding it, someone could actually just raise their hand and pose a question. So within the next 10 minutes or so, do we have a question or two that we might want to ask of one of our participants?
Can I yell something in here, which I think is very important to understand? The comment about 70 year is, I think, fundamentally wrong. If we look today, the current ideas which we are using and fully don't understand in tunneling diodes and in quantum mechanics, they come from 1923, Heisenberg and Schrödinger. So 70 years is not anywhere close to how much behind we are from theory to implementation. Right now, the most controversial ideas, the most radical ideas of quantum computing are from the books which are 23, 22, 21, 1921, 20. So 70 years is way too optimistic. Say 120 years and we are more realist. Sorry.
I would love to hear from Sari on that, and then we'll hear from Ash. Sari, what's your thinking about the time frame?
I think Hari is absolutely right. I think the 7 years it takes is from the general public to know about an idea. And I think Harri is a specialist in the in these issues, and he knows. And generally speaking, a lot of the inventions that we think that are very current, they already happened 100 years ago. So the seedlings of them, the seeds are there often for many, many years, and then they just start sprouting. So maybe, Harri, I stand corrected here, and maybe I have to change that from when the seedling starts sprouting to actually the general society to have adopted something so that we don't even think about it anymore. It maybe from that point to the it takes 7 years, and I think totally, Harri, you are right. The researchers do these innovations much earlier.
Well, one of the seeds of this conversation is that Ash has a contribution that they'd like to make that probably didn't wake up with this question in mind, but they have it now. So, Ash, what are your thoughts?
Thanks for this really interesting conversation. I'm, you know, this is some issues that I'm thinking about, and also have you know, looking to sort of explore more as well. My question is then, like the competing systems that exist, from my perspective, the ones that have that inclusion, that have, you know, the diverse voices, have the different perspectives included in that decision-making process, generally speaking, have legitimacy, have more informed decision-making, and so on. So my sort of thoughts are, you know, really thinking about the idea of technology facilitated, more direct participation. The current sort of system of government, we delegate people to do the governance for us. We vote for people, we delegate that responsibility. But, you know, given more free time, not free time, but, you know, shorter working weeks, more automation, there might be a time when we maybe have, say, a democracy day once a month where people vote directly on local, state, national issues from their phone, from their smartphone, from their laptop, like kind of like ballot measures on steroids, even though ballot measures, I'm not a big fan of ballot measures, but anyway, even though, you know, ballot measures with more direct representation. And then the other side of that question is then, you know, the voices that contribute towards the framing or the, you know, the creation of those ballot measures and things like that, and how direct democracy might utilize technology. So I'm just really thinking about that idea of greater direct democracy participation that's facilitated by technology. And I would be interested in comments or reflections about that idea. Thank you.
Lou, what's your take on, well, actually, sorry, I think you just turned on your mic, so I want to hear from you first, but Lou and Harri, you're absolutely next on deck. Sorry, what's your take on direct democracy? The technology of getting there is absolutely interesting, but the value of direct democracy, is that containing the seeds of its own destruction, or is that a path we need to go, or you imagine something a little bit more in between?
Ash, I'm totally would love to live in your hopeful world, and I would like to be able to take a day from all my other things to focus on democracy. Sometimes I would like to use my AI assistant to do all that voting and community involvement, but I truly think that it would help us psychologically to to be more engaged in our community and work more on smaller issues and understand the diverse issues that are around us. I think that would make us more humane and more understanding and have more empathy. And I think that is the trend that is now rising, empathy. And how we could do that through being engaged in democratic or other new ways of political systems. I think that would be, I definitely put your suggestion there in my hopeful futures.
And in the art and the hope of not being overly poetic, I find a connection between what you just said and something that Lee wrote in the chat in relation to the quantum mechanics discussion. And I'm just so happy that I'm not the only one who's really excited about that part. I've heard the hydrogen bomb analogy used to explain societal function. A hydrogen atom, 99%. I hope I didn't say hydrogen bomb. I hope I said hydrogen atom. Anyway, the atom is 99% empty, but the space is filled. Here it comes with the bonding force. What is that bonding force? And one wonders if our ability to maintain and grow a sense of empathy is the thing that keeps a democracy flourishing, not to see each other as strangers, but as people suffering together on the same blue marble. By the way, Lou, we got to give credit to Lou, who dropped a pretty harsh indictment of Meta. Lou, do you want to unpack a little bit more how you are making a connection between Meta and MySpace? Because that's hardcore.
Well, I think Mark Zuckerberg is a ridiculous businessman. He has no idea what he's doing. He has just been given a lot of money. So that's one of the problems we have. People are given too much money to do stuff they shouldn't be having anything to do with. But as far as that goes, the way I see what's happening with Meta is they're trying to do something that isn't ready to be done. And they're going to lose an incredible amount of money. And they'll still be around in 10 years, but I do not think that they are going to be the power that they are. I don't think Google is either. And I don't know who's going to replace them. Hopefully it's not Elon Musk. But yeah, that's the case. And Ash, you know, I agree with Sari about what Ash had to say. God, I really wish that would happen. But as I said earlier, this is a nation of laws, not of people. And direct democracy is a really nice way of describing mob justice. Mm. You know, if everybody has a chance to make their decision, well, we're not in a place where we all agree. We have to get to a place where we at least agree on the basics, on human justice, on being decent to each other. And if we're not doing that, direct democracy can be absolutely horrendous. And that's why we need checks and balances. That's why a Republican, and I don't mean that as far as a party, a Republican form of government is a check and balance on the mob mentality. That's what was stated very clearly in the Federalist Papers, why we have the system we have today. So direct democracy is not an answer. It is good. I've seen some good involvement in that. I've been involved in some local committees on redistricting here in Redwood City. And that worked out to a certain degree. And we did it all through Zoom meetings. So the discussion was very good. So that can be helpful, but I don't see it as an answer.
I want to use that as an opportunity for me to turn this back over to Mina. And in doing so, I want to express my just genuine delight that we've talked about, you know, the ancient Athenian Agora and John Adams, and talked about the metaverse and quantum mechanics. And even still, we are focused like lasers on the fact that there is an election in the United States, the midterm elections, worthy of our time and attention. And so I'm hoping that at the end of this, we all remember that our goal is to act. We're here to talk, but ultimately we need to work as if our talk has meaning and application. So let me turn it over to Mina, who can maybe consider integrating one final question or comment. And then Mina, the final words, as they should be, are yours.
Dr. Wood, thank you so much for facilitating this stimulating, interesting panel. I have a question from Derek, and I would invite all of you, including you, Dr. Wood, to answer it briefly. Hari had to go. He had an engagement, so he was messaging me. He apologizes for leaving early. But here's the question. what about the common sentiment of the young people thinking that their vote doesn't matter? What would you say to that one? Any one of you?
Okay, that has been a basic problem with every demographic unit in any democracy for the entire history of democracy. You get the feeling that you vote and what you wanted doesn't happen. I mean, that's what we're seeing with the MAGA crowd. They are definitely in the minority, but they think that their way should be done immediately, because they actually believe that they're in the majority, and they're not. Most of us aren't. As individuals, we are fine. We have opinions, but we do not have the majority opinion. And we have to get to a place of grace in our own lives where we're willing to accept what the majority decides. And until we get to that place, we're going to continue to believe that our vote doesn't count. But it does. It does, it does, it does. And you've got to keep going at it. I can't remember. I can count maybe on the fingers of both hands how many times a political issue has been decided in the way I thought it should go. I should be the most frustrated of all, but I still believe that my vote counts.
And something Lou, you
thank
said-
Thank you for coming to the panel. Yeah,
and
go ahead,
Dr. Wood. Just a brief sentence, and then I want to hear from Sari on this one. But I would merely add philosophically, there is a certain absurdity to imagining that our lives have consequence when we're surrounded by forces that's seemingly beyond our control. And so what do? We just give up? No, we act as if our choices have consequence. And we discover after the fact that they do, that we didn't quite know how, but afterwards we look back and realize there is some cause and effect to the world. And I'm not going to give up on my hope and having an effect from the cause of going to vote and talking to my neighbors and disagreeing with people, but in an agreeable manner, even if I don't see the immediate response, I must act as if my choices have consequence, because I'm not sure how else I would care to live. Sari, what do you think?
Yep, so I totally believe that this is a time to really choose who you're going to vote in a way that you have never chosen what you're voting for and who you're going to vote. There was a recent research of young people, 25 year olds and down from that age, which asked what they think of the state of the world. And never has there been asked pessimistic answers as now. So 56% of the 25-year-olds and under believe that that this world is coming to an end within their lifetime. And I'm an older person, and that was not the case when I was 25-year-old. I really, really believed in a hopeful future. And I have been working for several different countries, one of them the US and several different countries and the EU and the UN, as a person doing foresight scenarios of the future. I most of my work is not public, which is really sad, because that's why I'm working on the TV series, because I want to show everybody that the hopeful 2092 is very attainable. What we hear from the media is dystopian futures. And that's really not how the situation is. The hopeful futures are very attainable. We just need to do that. So if you have voted before, vote now, but choose who you're going to vote really well. This is now the time to act. And this is now the time to really believe in the hopeful futures. That's how we're going to get them.
So that's our marathon episode of Crucial Tech for this week. Thanks for listening. I won't belabor it any further. If you have any questions or comments, go to anchor.fm/crucialtech. You can leave a 1-minute audio question or comment, or you can go to cyberprotection-magazine.com and leave us a message there. We'll get back to you on that as well. Thank you for listening. This has been Crucial Tech, a Foot Washer Media production.